I'm also the faculty advisor to SPARC, the Student Political Awareness and Responsibility Coalition. And since, as far as I can tell, no one from SPARC has shown up tonight, I'll say a bit about what the organization is or was. In 1985, student activists working on the divestment struggle to get the university to divest in corporate stocks with investments in South Africa started the SPARC as a means of bringing in alternative speakers of the sort that weren't invited by the mainstream student association speakers bureau, and has since had the task of providing left and progressive balance for mainstream speakers in general on the campus. Tonight's speaker is Dr. Michael Parenti. Some of you who've been around the campus for a while know Michael from the period when he taught here in 1970 to 1972. He was one of the most prominent anti-war activists on the campus and did a great deal to help many of us get more organized and more involved in the anti-war movement, both faculty and students. In 1972, when Michael was up for reappointment, the Board of Trustees reversed the entire university from the Political Science Department's recommendation all the way up to the President's office. And for the first time in the nearly 200-year history of the university, the trustees directly fired a faculty member, Michael. The chairman of the board at the time was a man named Scott, a vice president in General Motors, and he remarked that he, quote, wasn't going to have a socialist teaching on his campus, unquote. So Michael was terminated, even though he was extensively published, indeed one of the few international scholars on the campus that year. Michael went on to run for Congress on the Liberty Union ticket in 1974, scoring, as I recall, some 15% of the vote, and helping to make Liberty Union give Liberty Union the major party status it enjoyed for the rest of the 1970s and into the 1980s. Michael has a PhD from Yale University, which he received in 1962. He's taught at Sarah Lawrence College and at the State University of New York at Albany. He's been a visiting professor at the University of Illinois, Howard University, Brooklyn College of the City College of New York, and the University of Canterbury in New Zealand, most recently at California State College at Northridge. His recent books are Democracy for the Few, now in a fifth edition, Inventing Reality, The Politics of the Mass Media, The Sword and the Dollar, Imperialism, Revolution, and the Arms Race, and Make-Believe Media, The Politics of Entertainment. Since the reason the trustees fired Michael was to get him permanently off the campus, it gives me great pleasure to invite him back to speak to us tonight.
Thank you. It's very nice to be here again. I'm going to talk about conspiracy and state power, which really is about conspiracy and class power. I'd start off by saying that the existing political economic system we have can be looked at in three basic ways. First, you can approach it as a conservative celebration. The conservative celebration tells us how wonderful the free market economy is, how more wonderful it could be were it not for meddlesome government regulations and the demands of undeserving low-income welfare chiselers and people like that. The second approach is a liberal complaint, which is about how some of our priorities are all wrong and how there are serious problems that represent aberrant departures from an otherwise basically good system. The third approach is a radical analysis that sees ecological crises, military interventions, the national security state, homelessness, poverty, an inequitable tax system, undemocratic social institutions such as the corporate-owned media, not as aberrant outcomes of a basically rational system, but as the rational outcomes of a system whose central goal is the accumulation of wealth and power. Not power for power's sake, but power is needed to, you need more and more power to have control, to protect your wealth, to protect your way of life as you know it and love it, a way of life which really involves living off the labor of others and accumulating vast wealth off their labor. If you take the third perspective and say there's a privileged class and there's a class, not a class system, but a class power system, you can say there's class structure. Mainstream bourgeois sociologists talk about a class structure, upper middle, lower middle, upper, lower, lower, and stratification. They treat class as a sociological, demographic, income distribution factor. But to talk about class in a different way, as class power, that is, that there's a certain group of people who have a certain relationship to the means of production, who control the resources of society in a certain way, who control labor, or extract from every bit of human labor in the private sector and even directly in the public sector a sum of the value that's created by that labor, which they pocket themselves. Just as the protection racket mafioso might go around and go to every store and say, a little part of your earnings you give to me. It's the money you earn without working. If you argue that there is this, and as I've argued it, I argued that all of human beings are divided into column A and column B. Column A is made up of those people who live off stock dividends, interest on bonds and securities, land and mineral royalties, speculative investments and rents. And column B, which I think is more heavily represented tonight, column B is made up of those people who live principally off wages and salaries, fees, commissions, and pensions. The one thing that column A and column B people both have in common is that they both live off the labor of the people in column B. And then if you argue that that economic system also is a class power system, that capitalism is not just an economic order, it's a whole social order, which affects the cultural and political dimensions. So Joan takes pictures when I gesture. That's the medium. Great. If you say that, if you take that third perspective, if you don't indulge in a conservative celebration or a liberal complaint, but actually engage in a radical analysis, if you take that third perspective, you cross an invisible line and will be labeled in mainstream circles as a conspiracy theorist or a Marxist, or even a paranoiac, terms which are sometimes treated as coterminous. In 1837, Abraham Lincoln remarked, quote, "These capitalists generally act harmoniously and in concert to fleece the people." Now today, Abe Lincoln would be dismissed as a conspiracy theorist. He was ascribing conscious intent to a class interest. For some people, conspiracy is by definition ridiculous and non-existent. I mean, there are an awful lot of people who think they've demolished an argument when they can lean back and say, oh, what do you have, a conspiracy theory? Which at that point you're supposed to utterly deny that you do. But conspiracy, in fact, is a real thing. In fact, it's a concept in law. Conspiracy means literally planning or acting together in secret, especially for an unlawful or harmful purpose, often with the use of illegal means. I mean, that's a real thing. There are people who sometimes go to jail for conspiracy. It's really come, in popular parlance, it's really come to mean any machination, any plot, any concerted deception. I have argued in my books, in Democracy for the Few, Empowering the Powerless, even in Inventing Reality, I think, that the state's major mode of operation is systemic and legalized rather than conspiratorial. No ruling interest could control a whole nation through the machinations of a secret cabal pulling some secret strings. There have to be overt, massive methods of legitimation and political acculturation that are going on all the time. At the same time, no ruling class could survive if it wasn't attentive to its own interests, consciously trying to anticipate, control, initiate events both at home and abroad, both overtly and secretly, both non-conspiratorially and conspiratorially. It would be hard to imagine a state that where there was no such conspiracies or such plans. In the United States, I'll give you, there have been conspiracies aplenty. and this is not my view, this is a matter now of public record, the deliberately fabricated Tonkin Gulf incident, which served as an excuse for escalating the Vietnam War. You mean the president deliberately lied and fabricated an attack by the Vietnamese on U.S. ships that never really happened, just as an excuse to enter the war? Yes, that's what I mean. That's what everybody means when they investigated the Tonkin Gulf. The Operation Phoenix in Vietnam, which U.S. forces set up assassination squads that murdered thousands of dissidents in Vietnam. Secret organizing, illegal, immoral, unpublicized. The Watergate break-in, followed by the Watergate cover-up. There were two conspiracies there. Nixon was got on the second, not on the first, but on the cover-up. The FBI COINTELPRO, involving dirty tricks, infiltration, and harassment of left dissident groups, often illegal break-ins, all sorts of things that were done, including threats and endangering the physical safety of members of dissident groups and the like. Iran-Contra, in which the executive leaders conspired to circumvent the law, to go around the law and go around the Constitution and go around Congress and go around public opinion to wage a war in financing funds for the covert operations in Nicaragua. I mean, the Congressional Joint Committee that investigated Iran-Contra said, this is a conspiracy of momentous dimensions. We may never get at the bottom of it. I remember saying, certainly not the way you guys are investigating it, you won't. Not calling George Bush, Vice President George Bush, and what his role was in and the like. The BCCI scandal involving what some call the most crooked bank in the world. That's going some to be the most crooked bank in the world when you think of the choices you have. Thank you. The CIA drugs for guns trade in Central America. Exposed in the Houston Post, at least some of it was exposed. When he got too hot, the series was killed and he was let go. He had to write a book about it. Covert CIA-sponsored terrorist wars in a dozen countries, from Angola, which is going on right now as we sit here today, from Angola to Mozambique to East Timor to Central America and the like. The concerted planned overthrow of democratically reformist governments in places like Chile and Guatemala and about seven or eight other countries. The savings and loan scandal, a conspiracy that the Bush Justice Department itself called 1,000 conspiracies of theft, bribery, and fraud. 1,000 conspiracies. They said we don't have enough agents to investigate all of the conspiracy. The greatest financial crime in the history of humanity in terms of the sheer amounts of money that were taken. And you're going to be, by the way, you're going to be paying for that the rest of your lives, and your children will too. You're talking about upwards of $1 trillion. That is that portion of your tax money which they take from your check, for which you'll get nothing. You'll get nothing back for it, just paying off the savings and loan scandal that will go on. Conspiracies are regularly carried out by the national security state. The national security state is composed of the following. It's a term to mean the White House Executive Office, elements within the Departments of State and Defense, the National Security Council, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the National Security Agency, the CIA, and other intelligence agencies. The CIA has a $29 billion budget, it is said, so they must be doing something else besides gathering information. I mean, it doesn't cost that much to gather information. The national security state is involved in secretly planned operations around the globe. These are all conspiracies. They are secret, they are illegal, they often use illicit and illegal means, and they are not publicized, and their intentions and their particulars are systematically misrepresented or denied to the general public. So they're not only conspiracies, but they're undemocratic. They're outside the democratic process of accountability. The CIA resorts to low-intensity warfare, special forces, undercover agents, surveillance and infiltration, and destruction of dissident groups, the murder and assassination of dissident political leaders around the world, the bribing of state leaders, unlawful break-ins, the training of death squads, counterinsurgency suppression, and terrorist military forces against revolutionary governments, as in Angola, Mozambique, Nicaragua, and against Cuba, for instance. Now, the rulers themselves admit that these things go on. They don't call them conspiracies, they call them covert operations, deep secret, clandestine operations, national security. They will say, we can't talk about these things, national security. If they're not conspiring, then why all the secrecy? I remember when my friend Philip Agee had he wrote a book called Inside the Company. Philip Agee had been a CIA agent, and he broke with the CIA when he suddenly realized he went in very idealistic to advance the cause of democracy and whatever else, and he discovered that the CIA was doing all sorts of other things but that or against that, and he got disillusioned and left and wrote a book, and the book was banned in the U.S. And the national security apparatchik said, for national security reasons, that book cannot be circulated in the United States. Now, I thought it was very curious at the time, because the book had already been published in 6 different languages in about 15 different countries. It was in England, it was in French and German and Spanish and Portuguese, Italian. It was out already. And I said, well, doesn't the KGB have anybody who reads German or Spanish? I mean, they could get this book already, you know. It was even available in English in Canada. And then I said, oh, of course, but foreign agents aren't allowed in bookstores in Canada, so why were they banning a book that was already out around the world? It wasn't to keep it from the enemy for national security reasons. It was to keep it from the American public for the political interests of the national security state, to not to let you know what's going on. So not only do they have conspiracies, but they have cover-up of their conspiracies. They take elaborate measures to cover up and keep you from seeing things. I always thought the more chilling conspiracy in the JFK assassination, the assassination of John F. Kennedy, was not the assassination of Kennedy, but the other, far bigger conspiracy in terms of the number of operations and things done and witnesses killed and all that, which was the cover-up of the assassination. When you read about the cover-up, the missing physical evidence, this, that, the other thing, the witnesses who die and all that, you realize that there's a much more massive conspiracy that went on there. In fact, they will kill members of their own establishment if they're taking a course that's going in the wrong direction. And there's an awful lot of independent investigation and evidence that's come up on this stuff people ought to look at before they poo-poo conspiracies. The existence of a national security state demonstrates that along with issue politics, which we're always looking at, this issue, healthcare, that issue, gays in the military, this issue, value-added tax, blah, blah, all these issue politics, we have class rule. And in academic political science and in our news media, issue politics are either ignored or they're looked at in a kind of vacuum. You can look at this issue, that issue, that issue, but it's in a vacuum. It's never in a frame of reference of class rule and class power. Some political scientists, I can think of two prominent ones at Berkeley, Nelson Polsby, Aaron Wildowski. I remember at the APSA convention being on a panel with them both and turning to Wildowski and saying, how could you study the American presidency for 30 years? They've written books on the American presidency and never mention capitalism and corporate interests. It's rather remarkable that you never bring in the question of class rule. What does the president do in relation to these immense powers and interests and concerns? In fact, class interests permeate issue politics, as you know, tax policies, subsidies to corporate investments, corporate plunder of public lands. All these things are issue politics, they're interest group politics, but they have a class dimension. But issue politics does not encompass the totality of the class system. Class rule is not achieved solely by pressure group politics with big campaign donations, lobbyists, and other manifestations of interest group politics. That's only part of the story. Interest group politics operates within a systemic totality of power and class interests. That is to say, it operates within the dynamics of a capitalist system which, over and above the desires of any individual elites, imposes its own necessities. There are things that must be done if the system is to be maintained. If value is to be extracted from the labor of the many to the coffers of the few, if profit levels are to be maintained, there's got to be central financing and subsidizing. There's got to be regulating and cushioning of competition. There's got to be transferring public domain resources into private corporate hands. There's got to be transferring public financial resources through the tax system into private hands. There's got to be absorbing into the public realm, and not only does it go from the public to the private, the wealth goes from the public to the private. You can see that right now with Clinton's aid to Yeltsin. What is it? Billions of dollars to capitalize, to capitalism, to use the public tax money of the American people to finance capitalism to get it going. So there's immense amount of wealth that's constantly going from the public to the private, subsidizing, research and development. Whole industries are created by socialism in America. By socialism, I mean by public financing, which are then handed over for private exploitation. Electronics, communications, the railroad industry, the nuclear industry, one could go on. Whole industries, much of the research and development in the military industries are also go from public to private. At the same time, there's something that goes from private to public. That is, the diseconomies of capitalism are then socialized. The toxic waste dumps, the unemployment, the poverty, all those things are in turn socialized, so that the private entrepreneur, always bragging about how more efficient he is and all that, tosses the diseconomies of his system onto the public. It'll become our concern. A toxic waste dump, that's something the public has to deal with. Pollution is something we have to deal with. Illiteracy, that's something we have to deal with. Unemployment, we have to deal with that. Underemployment, occupational safety, sickness of people at work, and all those diseconomies are tossed onto us, and then the private sector can brag about how more efficient it is and how wasteful the public sector is. And the other thing the state must do, and along with all that, the prime thing, the really top concern, is to act as a conscious agent of class control, to mobilize repressive forces at home and abroad, to mobilize a police power, to limit and repress dissent, to control information and manipulate opinion. Those all become part of what the state does. In fact, that is the essence. That is the essence of what the state is. The essence of the state is to act as an overarching conscious agent. If I have millions of dollars and my job is to make more millions of dollars, I don't want to worry about that. That's what I give you to worry about. That's why you're working in the CIA or the FBI or in the State Department. That's your job, is to make sure that capitalism is propagated everywhere all the time and it is safe. That is, make sure that the world is safe for the people in column A against the demands and resistances of the people in column B. That's a conscious thing you must do. To put it simply, the function of the capitalist state is to sustain the capitalist order. In sustaining capitalism, the state has a monopoly of the legitimate use of force. It has the power to develop technologies of control, to raise army and other security forces. It also has its access to the public wealth. It taxes through a non-voluntary tax system. It takes the money of the working people, so we're not only exploited as workers. It's always the thing is, oh, we're exploited as workers, our surplus value is expropriated from us. But after the money we do take home in our paycheck, they take another hit on it as taxpayers. They get you again and expropriate money through the tax system, which they then can use to finance their wars and their repressive mechanisms and all sorts of things. They couldn't do it themselves. The bourgeoisie has no interest in spending those kinds of funds to defend its class system. Rather, it uses, through the taxing power of the state, they get the public to do it for them. Now, you're likely to be called a conspiracy theorist, not only if you believe that ruling class leaders sometimes use conspiratorial methods, but if you believe there is even such a thing as a ruling class that uses the power and wealth of the state to buttress its overall class hegemony. even if you think there's such a thing as consciously organized wealth, people sometimes say, conspiracy. Not only is there a denial that ruling interests act conspiratorially, there's a denial of the existence of ruling interests, that there's such a thing as ruling interests. If you say there are ruling interests, you think there are some people at the top who are running things? No, No, it just all happens kind of automatically, just like that. Nobody, those guys in Washington aren't doing anything like that. Well, who is this corporate class that you talk about, Parenti? Who is this ruling class? What do you mean? I'm talking about the top 400 families that are listed in Forbes in the Social Register, almost a third of whom are the direct descendants linked by blood or marriage to the Rockefeller, DuPont, Mellon, and Morgan dynasties. I'm talking about the super rich 1% that owns 70% of the nation's wealth. I'm talking about the top 800,000 individuals who have more wealth and income than the other 184 million combined. I'm talking about people over the age of 16. There's 800,000 people in this country who have more wealth than the rest of the population combined, take all their wealth in value. The economist Paul Samuelson gave that image some 30 years ago. He said, if you were to use children's play blocks, and each block was worth $1,000, and you wanted to look at the income distribution, and you piled up the blocks, the very richest would have a tower of children's play blocks that went vastly higher than the Eiffel Tower. It would go higher. Whereas almost all the rest of us would be not more than a yard or yard and a half off the ground. Gives you an idea of what the disparities is. Now, instead of, and I'm also talking, when I'm talking about the national security state, I was very specific there too, that is the politically active element of the ruling class. Not all its members may be rich, by the way. In fact, many of them may come from modest backgrounds, but they have to ascribe to the ideology, to that perspective. Henry Kissinger wasn't rich. Richard Nixon wasn't rich. Lyndon Johnson wasn't rich. Harry Truman wasn't rich. But they generally are rich afterwards. As they come into the service, they become rich. Henry Kissinger is now a millionaire. Richard Nixon is now a millionaire. Lyndon Johnson died rich. Maybe Harry Truman is about the only exception who wasn't really a multimillionaire. But you have to get recruited into their ranks, you have to, of course, ascribe to their ideology. Can you imagine someone with my perspective being invited on the Council of Foreign Relations or on the Trilateral Commission or the like? It wouldn't happen. I mean, there's a conscious, and it's not simply because my number just didn't happen to come up in the bag. They consciously recruit certain people who say and do and read and research the right things. Henry Kissinger did stuff that the Rockefellers and the Council of Foreign Relations boys liked, and that was the most enriching thing in his life. He got pulled up his books. They noticed it. They financed it. They brought him along, and before long he was a national figure and became Secretary of State and an advisor to presidents and the like. Instead of conspiracy theory, what the apologists for power will give us is what I call innocence theory. There's a variety of innocence theories. There's somnambulist theory or sleepwalkers theory, which says that those in power just do things as if they're walking in their sleep. You know, they just do. David Rockefeller gets up and he says, what should I do today? Should I watch after my vast holdings and interests and all that? No, that would just be feeding into the conspiracy theorists. No, I just won't do anything. Along with that, we can explain their hegemony as a coincidence theory. By sheer chance, things just happen repeatedly and coincidentally to benefit their interests without any conscious connivance by them. It's most uncanny. They happen to attack those countries that are Marxist-Leninist or populist nationalist or Islamic nationalist or whatever, that countries that in which leaders are trying to redistribute some of the land in national income and use of resources and pricing for the benefit of their people. They just happen to hit those countries, and they just happen to give aid to the comprador countries where the leaders open the country up to the corporations, say, come on in, take what you want, don't worry, no taxes, no minimum wage, no environmental protections, it's all yours. Those countries we just happen by coincidence to be having friendly terms with, and the other countries we just happen to not like because they're mean and threatening and they might hurt us, and so that's why we go after them. A frequent mode of explanation of innocence theory is stupidity theory, that these people just don't know what they're doing. They just don't know what they're doing. It's just stupid policy. Well, stupid. Why are we in Vietnam? The whole policy is so stupid. I used to hear that, you know. It's not stupid. Just because you don't know what they're doing doesn't mean they don't know what they're doing. You know, they know what they're doing. They don't want that kind of social revolutionary movement in Indochina or anywhere else. The stupidity theory was even used as, I'm not just making this stuff up, as Jay Leno would say, I'm not making this up, this is really in the news. The stupidity theory was actually used as a defense by Ronald Reagan during Iran-Contra. Do you remember the Towers Commission that he had appointed came along and said it was just a mix-up. The president didn't know what was going on. He has a very loose, and he should be criticized for this. Boy, they really got independent there. He should be criticized for a loose management style. And he himself got up and said, I guess I have been guilty of not being hands-on enough in my management of these things. And we were asked to believe that the president knew nothing about this. But now we have, again, as a matter of public record, we have several people, not inconsequential, like Oliver North, like Secretary of Defense Weinberger, like the Secretary of State, George Shultz, coming out and saying the president knew all along. He not only knew, it was his policy. He was the one who opted for it. Those who hold to innocence theory would have us believe that unjust social arrangements and wrongful policies are just momentary aberrations. So there's momentary aberration theory. There's incompetence theory. There's unintended consequences theory. There's innocent cultural proclivities theory. I mean, to be sure, these things do exist. I mean, there are sometimes unintended consequences. There are cultural influences and all that. We're not saying it isn't. But do they explain, are they the reasons for the major policy decisions of political and economic leaders? Can that really explain what these guys are doing? I mean, evidence and common sense suggest that the rich and the powerful are not oblivious to their interests. They do not leave things to chance. There's also paranoia theory. That is, those of us who see evil and evildoers are called paranoid. The Sandinistas in Nicaragua, who were trying to develop a new society, a new country, with using a larger portion of the resources of their country for the benefit of their own people, going through land reform, taking land from the filthy rich and giving it to the poor peasants and doing things like that. For years, the United States financed, equipped, and trained a counter-revolutionary army that went in there and killed and destroyed daycare centers and health clinics and burned farms and all that sort of thing, killed tens of thousands of Nicaraguans, hit power stations, schools, brought ruination to the nation's economy. We had fleets on both of Nicaragua's shores. We sent planes violating their airspace to do surveillance. We threatened. Reagan said he wanted the Sandinistas to cry uncle, which they did finally in an election. George Shultz, Secretary of State, said he wants to cast out the Sandinistas from our hemisphere. Yet when the beleaguered Sandinistas charged the U.S. with wanting to overthrow them, ABC News dismissed the charge as, quote, the Sandinista paranoia. The Washington Post, quote, Nicaraguan paranoia. In a speech at the United Nations, psychiatrist Jean Kirkpatrick diagnosed the Sandinista. I always thought she was a political scientist, but she suddenly bloomed that day in the UN debate as a psychiatrist. She diagnosed the Sandinista position as, quote, paranoid schizophrenics. Oh, genius, so smart. I would have never known that, you know? This was after Reagan and Shultz had announced that they wanted to do in the Sandinistas. Paranoics. I remember what James Baldwin said years ago, that even paranoiacs have real enemies, you know. I remember here when I was at UVM and members of my department said, you're in, you're going to get your contract renewed. The department wants it, the Council of Deans, the faculty committee, Senate committee on renewal and tenure, you're in. I said, I'm not going to be renewed. The Board of Trustees, which is made up of conservative rich businessmen, are going to overrule all you guys because that's where the power is, and they're not going to renew my contract. And I remember a colleague of mine, I won't say his name, turning to me and saying, oh, radical paranoia. You got radical paranoia. And I remembered what Baldwin said, even paranoiacs have real enemies. My son used to have a cartoon poster up on his wall. It shows two steer in the fields, and one of them has this very anguished look on its face like that. And it's saying, and the little balloon is saying, "Oh, I just discovered how they make hamburgers." And the other steer is looking at him sort of saying, "There you go, you leftist paranoias with your conspiracy theories again, always worrying." Historian Frankowski raises a very interesting point. He says, well, are we asking people a lot to believe in conspiracies, are we? Not as much as if you ask them not to believe. Actually, that's my point. That's Kofsky, but I'm coming to Kofsky. Not as much as you ask them not to believe in conspiracy. I mean, how do you explain this stuff if you don't believe in conspiracies? And Kofsky comes in, he puts it very well in a book he wrote called Harry Truman and the War Scare of 1948. It'll be out next fall. I just read it in manuscript. But this is what he has to say. What would those who are so ready to derisively exclaim conspiracy theory have us believe? That people with enormous fortunes and or high political positions do not have greater opportunity than the ordinary citizen to get what they want? That men and women who spend most of their adult lives seeking to obtain or retain money and influence do so only in order to abstain from employing the advantages these confer? That those with wealth and power are inhibited by some mysterious force from making use of their wealth and power to accomplish their purposes? That the rich and well-placed refuse to cooperate with each other in the pursuit of common political economic goals? That's pretty extraordinary to think that. If, in fact, there was one thing that characterizes those at the top, this is Kofsky still talking, it is their readiness to organize amongst themselves to secure their desires. No other group in society even comes close in this regard, the way they can finance and coordinate and organize themselves. That's me talking. And really, it is ironic, end of quote, it is ironic how the group that's most organized to concert, most organized to control, is to be least considered as doing so by the innocence theorists. School teachers can be organizing. You can talk about school teachers organizing, unionizing, consciously pursuing their interests. Small farmers, machinists, sanitation workers, you could talk about them. Some profession, you yourself consciously make calculations about your interests and what you're going to do and what you can't do, what courses you might take, what profession you're going to do, what it might cost, blah, 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 what you might do this summer and all that. You can do that. But the minute you suggest that there's human agency in these larger configurations of institutional power and class wealth, the minute you suggest that they, that the Morgans and Rockefellers, that they consciously concert with the Henry Kissingers and the George Shultzes and the Ronald Reagans, that they consciously concert to advance and protect their interests, it's a conspiracy theory. I'll read you one other interesting quote. William Appleman Williams, his description of the power wielders in the Woodrow Wilson era administration. Woodrow Wilson was president of the United States. He was talking about 1918 was the year he was referring to. In 1918, a description that is still very apt. He talked about the men in and around the Woodrow Wilson administration. Quote, first, none of them was naive or innocent. They very seldom blundered into either success or failure. Many more times than not, they won because they shrewdly picked their spots and deployed their power effectively. All of them, furthermore, had extended experience in business and politics. They were also men who had come to terms with and practiced the kind of routine casuistry, the kind of routine deceptions and rationales that often seem to be inherent in the conduct of big business, big law, domestic politics, and diplomacy. They were not dishonest in the usual meaning of that term, and they were not hypocrites. They were simply powerful and influential men of this world who had concluded from hard experience and close observation that all of the truth all of the time was almost always dangerous. Hence, they did not use all of the truth all of the time. Secondly, these American decision makers viewed economics as of extremely great, if not of literally primary importance in the dynamic operation of the American system. This does not mean they were motivated by personal pocketbook considerations. By the way, I disagree with that. I think they were motivated by personal pocketbook considerations along with other things. They very much were worried about their own particular interests and investments and the like, and often would influence specific policies in regard to specific investments. Continuing quote, it means that they thought about economics in a national sense. I agree with that, but those two things are not mutually exclusive. You can be both. As an absolutely crucial variable in the functioning of the system per se, and as the foundation for constitutional government and a moral society. And all of them viewed overseas economic expansion as essential to the continued successful operation of the American free enterprise system. Finally, these men shared a central conviction that the good society and the good world were defined by the forms and substance of Western civilization as they had manifested themselves in the United States. Some were conservatives concerned to preserve aspects of the status quo that they considered particularly valuable. Others were reformers more interested in improving the existing order, sort of Bill Clinton's, you know. But all of them shared a fundamental belief in and a commitment to the established system. Sometimes the innocence theorists do place responsibility. If they do say there is responsibility, generally the view is no one's responsible. These are just things that happen in the way I just said. But they'll sometimes place, when they do place responsibility, it's often on everyone, an undifferentiated we, which means really no one in particular. Eric Fromm, I remember, talked about, we produce cars with built-in obsolescence and dangers. We continue to pollute the environment. Well, we don't produce those cars. We're not asking for those cars. I didn't ask for public transit systems to be ripped up so that we could have automobiles. A lot of people didn't do that. An alternative radio commentator announced in 1991, quote, on KPFA, we are all guilty of John Kennedy's death. We are all guilty of the Gulf War. No, we're not all guilty. We're not all guilty. We didn't all do this. A lot of us opposed it. A lot of us want to get at the truth. A lot of us resisted it. The innocence theorists get quite specific about conscious intent. There's only one occasion where they will recognize there is conscious intent, conspiratorial power of a very sinister nature, and that's when they're talking about the left. Militant dissidents, labor unions, leftist guerrillas, peace advocates. You remember during the nuclear freeze movement, which started right here in Vermont in the town meetings, during the nuclear freeze movement, the FBI was going around saying that the KGB was behind the nuclear freeze movement. 10 million people. Referenda in what was it, about 11 states in the Union, passed in 10 of 11 states. All that, the incredible democratic upsurge of democratic forces, and the FBI had a conspiracy theory. Suddenly, conspiracy theories are okay. The Communist Party, conspiracy theory, they're subverting us and all that. So they will use conspiracy when it applies to people on the left. They do see the conscious use and pursuit of power if you're talking about people who are opposing the existing class power interests, but not people who are serving those interests. Revolutionaries are capable of conspiracy, they will say, of concerted actions directed toward consciously desired goals, but not counter-revolutionaries. By the way, nothing I say here is meant to imply that the ruling class is infallible, that it's totally organized or omnipotent and unified. They have dissensions. They have differences about tactics. They make mistakes. But you see, their mistakes are, they have such a depth of resources that their mistakes are not all that costly. They have serviceable resources that can come in and compensate and rescue situations. They deal with circumstances that are sometimes beyond their control. They deal with pressures within the economic system that they'd rather do away with, by the need to maintain legitimating democratic appearances sometimes. They're sometimes limited by their fear of angry and mass popular reactions and resistance, sometimes. But whatever the limitations of their power, they are as fervently involved in the class struggle as any communist. And if they don't always succeed, they succeed often enough. They may not be omnipotent, they aren't, but they are enormously powerful. One of the things I've discovered, given this kind of conspiracy theory, given this kind of lack of class perspective in even much of the research on the left, is that researchers never ask why. Political activists often never ask why. I was just with a group of people in San Francisco. I'm living in the Bay Area now, in Berkeley, in San Francisco, who are concerned about U.S. policy toward Cuba. And I said, besides denouncing that policy, we also should ask, why is that policy? Why is Cuba being treated that way? And it was rather remarkable, because there was someone there who had been working for years, and she turned with keen interest and she said, why? Why is the U.S. doing this? It was a question that hadn't been asked. We're so busy denouncing these things that we don't ask why. Well, there are very real reasons. Cuba represents an alternative way of using the surplus value of the society, of treating people in column A and column B, treating both of those people quite differently. That's why, if you want to see who the U.S. targets, it's generally that or some variation of that. Or maybe a country with its trade or selling or buying policies is cutting in on the profit levels of the multinational corporations, as Saddam Hussein was trying to do with oil prices and the oil cartels. I mean, do you really think there would have been an Iraq war if Kuwait exported broccoli? But that's it. It's a lot of good books written exposing this, that, and everything, but never asking why. Books about the existence of U.S., looking at the existence of U.S. military bases all around the world. Beautiful discussion about how costly they are, how they violate the sovereignty of the countries they're in, how they're ecologically disastrous, the damage they do, this, that, and the other thing. But why do they exist? Why? I remember asking one of the authors, I said, why are all those bases there? Well, you know, it's not purely economic. It may not be purely economic, could we talk about that? What are the interests involved? Do these things just happen? Is that what it is? Whose interests are there? Who is benefited from this? That's why these things occur. So what happens is we learn how, even on the left, never to ask why. And those of us who ask why are, of course, branded as conspiracy theorists. And the media, of course, specializes in that. The media specializes in doing two things: totally omitting and suppressing and ignoring certain problems and certain political realities, or when they see them, giving you some description but never asking why that policy goes on or why that exists. Let's take the best of them. Bill Moyers, in a PBS television program, April 92, Moyers discusses the federal tax system. I remember I was off giving a lecture somewhere. I got back to my hotel. I put the TV on, and there was Moyers, and he starts talking. Our federal tax system, he says. He says, it's riddled with gross inequalities. Corporations have evaded taxes by investing overseas. And I'm looking, hey, you know, he points out how U.S. investors in Puerto Rico were exempt from paying taxes on earnings. Foreign investors make hundreds of billions of dollars in the U.S. and don't pay taxes. The tax structure is riddled with tailor-made exemptions that favor particular firms and big campaign contributors. I mean, sometimes you'll see in the tax code, it'll say persons who live on the Kay Islands involved in pharmaceuticals and this and that do not have to pay any tax. And it'll apply to one guy, you know, who got this thing tailor-made. Ross Perot had the tax code tailor-made, saved him $15 million in taxes. Remember, he went to Washington 1 year and got that all done. This is the, you know, Ross Perot, the man of the people, going to work working to shake the system up. As someone said, he's not shaking the system up, he shakes it down. Well, Moyes goes on with this, and I'm sitting there saying, well, what do you know? These things are flickering. And then he turns to his panel of experts, and he says, after he's presented all these things, and he says, isn't this just a case of good intentions gone awry? And I said, what? And he and his panelists then proceeded to talk about the deficit, the budget, the need for more investments. Not one of them referred to the things that had opened up the program. Not one of them said that the existing tax policy was decidedly not a case of just good intentions gone awry, but was an example of how wealthy interests consciously use their influence to extract special treatment under the law. In fact, it's kind of weird that I've got to make that point, that you've got to argue with people that they consciously use their influence. Those who argue that U.S. foreign policy is foolish and excessive also deny intent and never ask why. If taken in the larger context, U.S. policy appears consistent and sensible and predictable and mostly successful. Most media analysts lack this larger context, this larger context of class power and interest that I've been referring to again and again. So they look at specific policies and don't understand. They don't see how U.S. policy has, over the decades, consistently moved against any nation or social movement that tries to change the client-state relations of U.S. dominance, that tries to use a greater portion of its natural resources, markets, and labor for self-development, and that these are moves which infringe upon the interests of rich investors. The more money I can keep from my copper industry to pay my copper workers or to use to build roads and clinics, that's less money that goes to the copper industry. It cuts into their profits, and they don't want that sort of thing. Once you realize that about U.S. policy, you move from a liberal complaint to a radical analysis. You move from complaining about how foolish, how irrational, how stupid it is, why are we always going on the wrong side, why do we go in on the side of the rich latifundio owners and the whorehouse and gambling casino operators and these other plutocrats and the oligarchs and all, why don't we go in on the side of the peasants and these people? Once you realize the larger context, you see that the policy makes sense. There are two models of conflict in society. Model one says that people get into conflicts with each other because they misunderstand each other, that there's a failure of communication, that I misinterpret your motives, you misinterpret mine. After a while, it's hard to say who's acting and who's reacting, and we get into some kind of adversarial thing, and we're caught in a conflict that no one wants. And as the conflict escalates, so forth, it gets carried along by each side's own self-fulfilling fears or resentments and all that. And each side finds confirmation of aggressive intent in the other's defensive or anticipatory moves. That model of conflict does explain certain kinds of conflicts in societies, but between people, whatever else. There's another model. Model two says that certain conflicts occur not because of misunderstanding, but because both sides know all too well what the other is up to, and that at least one side has a conscious agenda that it wishes to impose in order to advance its own interests at the expense of the other side. And the conflict arises when the other side resists that, where there's a conflict of interests. So the conflict is not due to irrational misunderstanding, but to the pursuit of rational, substantive, and conflicting interests. And that model ought to be looked at more often, because that explains a lot more of political reality in America. Lundy Bankford takes exception to the notion that interpersonal, both interpersonal and international conflicts, are all variations of Model 1. She argues that, in fact, they are Model 2. Bancroft looks at male violence against women and imperial violence against weaker nations. It's very interesting. What she says about both are things I've been saying about both for years, but I think the originality is the way she juxtaposes both and puts them together like this. Male violence. Supposedly men batter women because they don't know what they're doing. Tormented and in pain, they lose control of themselves and they lash out at those they love. Well, having worked with chronic batterers, some people have come to a different conclusion. They've learned that they know precisely what they're doing. They choose the amount of violence they use. They set limits for themselves that they won't cross. And they use violence in particular ways in order to get the control they want, to elicit the right level of intimidation and response that they want. They'll even stop. When the police come in, they'll sit down and pretend they're reading the paper or watching TV, said, oh, I don't know, she's just getting hysterical, I don't know what it is. So they're perfectly much in control. It's not that they're out of control, they're in control. That's the whole function of oppression, you see. I mean, this point has to be made again and again. I mean, the whole idea of oppression is not that people oppress because they're unhappy. They oppress because they are advantaged by the oppression. The slave owners had slaves not because they were out of touch with their inner selves and weren't whole humans. They had slaves because they lived well off slaves. They had parties and feasts and hunting and dancing and courting, and they lived lives of leisure. They never worked. They loved it. And the male supremacist likes his advantages. When they say, why do men oppress women? I've argued, men oppress women because it's advantageous. The patriarch writes his own ticket. It's very important to point that out, because there's a lot of talk today about how men are themselves disadvantaged and hurt in their sexism because they're depriving themselves of the deeper gratifications of a more complete relationship, which may be true in the long run. But nobody lives in the long run. Everybody lives in the here and now. And the average patriarch did not noticeably complain about all the benefits and advantages that he got, the choice positions in society, the best paid jobs, the power, the wealth, the control, absolute control of his wife's money, if she had any, the decisions he might want, the indulgence of his more corrupt impulses on the women in his life, all those things he did with impunity. And she with total subservience. Bancroft goes on and says, and there persists a similar mythology about imperialism. Supposedly, U.S. rulers don't know what they're doing abroad. In their misguided attempts to help out in other parts of the world, they stumble into doing a lot of damage. We heard that during Vietnam. Our well intentions gone awry again. Bill Moyers lives. Good intentions gone. We went in there with the best intentions and, oh, we just happened to bomb the country down into smithereens and we got carried away. In the 1980s, that same kind of view was repeated about Nicaragua. Our leaders don't realize that Nicaragua is no threat, that it wants peace. If only they understood that, they wouldn't inflict such punishment upon the Sandinista government and the Nicaraguan people. Well, in fact, Nicaragua was a very real threat to U.S. leaders, and the U.S. leaders knew it. Any example of successful independent development, I'm quoting Bancroft, not tied to the superpower batterers of the world, is a tremendous danger to the ability of imperialists to continue to subjugate the rest of the world. True independence would set a dangerous example that would inspire others to attempt to gain control of their own lives and economic resources. I've been talking too long, so I want to skip some stuff here. aren't we just doing our own version of demonization? I mean, they have the demonization of the communist devils and the revolutionaries and all that. And aren't you, Parenti, just giving us a demonization of ruling elites? Are they really capable of supporting death squads, assassinations, and other violent deeds? By the way, the UN Commission just came out and said yes, right, in El Salvador. Yes, we discovered that 85% of the murders were done by these army groups and all that, and this was supported, financed, and backed by the U.S. And the media even had to report it. But they never make that next step, which is why? Why did the United States of America, why did our government support such a horrible action in El Salvador? But not asked. No one asked it, not even the critics of that policy are asking. Why inviting these people who are now treating this as a new revelation, that which we have been saying for the last 15 years about El Salvador? Why does that happen? What interests are involved? I remember speaking with a former CIA operative. He had been in the OSS under Wild Bill Donovan and all, and he was at Yale working. He was a Yalie, a man of mature years. He was working up in the library administration, that's the top administrative job. And I remember him saying to me, "Well, Michael, we live in a world that's not a very pretty place. There are some pretty mean characters out there, and we have to sometimes do some pretty mean things." So you justify the evil you perpetrate on the world by saying the world is full of evil. The evil, really, that was committed was simply the evil that these people in El Salvador were committing is that they were waging a struggle against the oligarchical families and the multinational corporate investors in El Salvador. That was their real sin. Even the chairman of a House subcommittee charged after the Salvadoran revelations came out, and his name was Robert Torricelli. Torricelli, who sponsored the repressive, aggressive law against Chile, suddenly had a revelation. He said, "The Reagan administration has lied to Congress for years about the Salvadoran armed forces' complicity in murder." He said, quote, "Every word uttered by every Reagan administration official about the observance of human rights in El Salvador should be reviewed for perjury. Welcome to reality, Congressman." He, Torricelli, went on and said, quote, "It is now abundantly clear that Ronald Reagan made these certifications in defiance of the truth." So you know they're lying every so often when the truth does peek out post hoc. I've been doing some primary research. I'm going to end it right here. just this last point. I've been doing some primary research on a conspiracy. What I have reason to suspect is the assassination of a president. It was a president who lived 140 years ago by the name of Zachary Taylor. He was the 12th president of the United States. You may remember that 2 years ago his tomb was opened because Clara Rising, a writer, had the suspicion that he had been poisoned. And they did a post-mortem autopsy on bone and hair and nail samples and announced that he hadn't been poisoned. And it was all over the media that Zachary Taylor had died of natural causes. Well, he died from eating, all the historians agree, he died from eating cherries and milk on July 4th, 1850, which, as you know, will kill you every time, so stay away from them. And I started reading accounts of the time, and it said that Zachary Taylor was a man of robust health. And I read Sten Forsevold's study on arsenic, and he said when anybody ostensibly in perfect health suddenly is seized with illness, vomiting and seizures and dies, you should suspect poisoning. Doesn't mean it is. And I got the reports. I got the reports done by the Kentucky coroners on Zachary Taylor's remains, and I found all sorts of funny things, that the arsenic level in his body was 5 to 15 times higher than today's normal level of all of us. We all have some arsenic as an element in the environment, especially in our highly chemicalized environment. We ingest some of it. I mean, the normal level is 0.2 parts per million grams, ppms, parts per million, 0.2 to 0.6, and Zachary Taylor had 3.0, 3.80, and the like, which was still not a lethal level, but made one. And then some questions about the samples, and if it's acute arsenic poisoning, most of the hair would be free of the arsenic anyway, and you just do sectional analysis, and no sectional analysis was done. Also discovered that he had a level of antimony in his body that was 50 or 60 times higher, I mean, lethal level. Antimony is like arsenic, a heavy metal element that was used as poison in the 19th century. It has a toxicity level higher than arsenic. Well, Taylor was taking a very strong stance against the expansion of slavery into the newly acquired Western territories. He took a very hard line and was the only guy holding it back, and even threatened the use of federal troops against Texas when Texas tried to annex New Mexico. He'd send an army down and knock off the Texas militia if they tried to move. I mean, he was very, very strong against the expansion of slavery. And when he died, that whole policy was totally reversed. Fugitive slave laws were strengthened, extension was opened up, and so forth and so on, the compromise, so-called compromise of 1850. Millard Fillmore came in totally over to the other side, a dramatic reversal. So I have reason to believe that their conclusions about Taylor dying of natural causes was something that could be seriously questioned. But at the time of the exhumation, one of the historians the historians, by the way, all poo-poos. Oh, what are we even doing this for? Let's stop this sort of thing. Historians are the keepers of the official records. You know, they don't want these things upset in any way. If you've written four books on Zachary Taylor and never even considered the idea that he might have been a victim like this, you're not going to come out and say, oh, yes, let's look at this and see what the deficiencies of my research are. You say, well, this seems sensationalist. Why don't you let the dead rest in peace and blah, 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 and so forth. One of the historians, Eugene Genovese, was asked, would any political protagonist in the United States of 1850 be capable of such a deed? This gets back to the question I just was entertaining before. Are these elites capable of such things? Genovese thinks not. He says, while granting that the political circumstances of the era, given what they were, an assassin would very likely be a pro-slavery Southerner, he concludes, quote, I can't imagine any Southern personalities who would have been involved in such a conspiracy. Now, when you say something like that, you're saying something about yourself. I can't imagine such a thing happening. You're saying you're a judicious, decent, non-extreme person who would imagine, you're incapable of imagining such a crazy, terrible thing happening. It's a very common phenomenon, both in the media and in academic research. The need to project yourself as a neutral, moderate observer. And what you really do is you neutralize your subject matter, not yourself. But when you neutralize a subject matter like political struggle, which is the most unneutral, charged, partisan thing in the world, when you do that, you are distorting it, you see. So, now as opposed to the person who says, I can't imagine these crazy, terrible, evil things happening. What does that say about you? You see, you're less legit. You're less credible. So he says, I can't imagine that. Then he adds, but there is always the possibility that there were some nuts who had access to him and did it. It would be some nuts, people out of my realm of reality. Well, ladies and gentlemen, history shows us that nuts are not the only ones capable of evil deeds. That gentlemen of principle and power, of genteel manner, can often arrive at very grim decisions. Yale, Harvard, Princeton graduates even. And if they commit crimes, it's not because they harbor murky and perverse impulses, but because they feel compelled to deal with the dangers posed to their way of life. This doesn't mean they're motivated only by personal pocketbook concerns. Not only, they are motivated by that too, I argue, but they also equate their personal interests, their vital economic interests, with the well-being of their society and nation. Or in this case, in the case of Taylor, with the cause of Southern rights. Far from being immoral or unscrupulous, their principles are so lofty as to place them above the restraints of ordinary morality. They don't act on sudden impulse. The feeling grows among them that something must be done, something that's best for all. And when they arrive at their decision, it's so compelling that they're no longer shocked by the extreme measures they're willing to employ. In fact, those measures are now today institutionalized. When you got schools for assassins training Latin American officers in bombings and death squads and all that sort of thing, it's no longer an agonizing personal struggle, should we do this or not. The execution of the unsavory deeds are made all the easier, by the way, by delegating them to lower level operatives. Whether it's the killing of a president or the killing of an archbishop in El Salvador, or the killing of a president in the Philippines, or the killing of a president in Chile, or the killing of a mass popular leader, as in South Africa last week. These things are, most of the evil in history is not perpetrated by lunatics or monsters or lone psychotics. Most of the evil is perpetrated by persons of responsibility and commitment, whose most unsettling aspect is really the apparent normality of their demeanor. When I talked to this guy at Yale, the most unsettling thing about him was what a nice chap he seemed like. Talking to me and telling me how they necessarily had to do some very terrible things. those of us who want to expose that and oppose that and look into that are not compelled by Camelot yearnings or lost messiah fixations. Those of us who want to know the truth about the Kennedy assassination, those of us who want to know the truth about what the ruling class does in national security state, we're not conspiracy theorists, we're conspiracy actualitists. And that desire of people mobilizing to expose unaccountable power, there's another name for it. It's not conspiracy theory. There's another name for it. It's called democracy. And there are some people up there who wouldn't know democracy if it hit them right in the face. Their whole task is to evade and deny and get around troublesome democratic forces. But democracy is what we're about, and let's have more of it. Thank you very much. The first question is, what can we do about it? I'm not going to answer that question. Next question. Organize, agitate, educate, and go on. What are you willing to do about it? Any other question? Yes.
Yeah, this is somewhat off the topic of your major class this evening, but it's something very current to the news.
Waco, Texas. Come
yes.
On. Who says people aren't predictable? No, I don't know. I'm not going to comment it on it. I don't know. It's a mess and a horrible thing, and I don't want to talk about it. That is a marginal case. I think that isn't the kind of conspiracy that I'm talking about. One does wonder why they felt necessary to go in the first place with such a massive display of force, because this group was in violation of arms laws or something in Texas. How the hell can you be in violation of arms laws in Texas? What do you need a missile, a nuclear missile, before you violate the laws in Texas? Put on your pickup truck. They say, I don't know about that. I don't know. All right, go ahead. Any other questions? Okay, I've numbed you all into silence. Thank you very much.